Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Humans Vexus Manchester with me, Clint Boone. This series is sponsored by our friends at Safer Roads GM, helping us to keep ourselves and each other safe on the roads of Manchester. This week I'm joined by co-founder and managing director of Manchester International Festival, Christine Court. Christine talks about how she found a dream career while she was still a teenager.
I've always had that dancing, spirit, clubs, live music. I love popular culture. Yeah. It's been in me forever, before I even knew what culture meant.
And she talks about how she wants to improve the next generation's opportunities with the Factory Project.
And Manchester has a brilliant cultural infrastructure, but it needs a building on this scale. And, you know, to have a truly flexible arts facility, we need it.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome to Humans Vexus Manchester the co-founder and current managing director of the Manchester International Festival. It's the first festival of its kind in the world, and this lady's work has brought into contact with such people as Damon Albarn, Brian Eno, Kenneth Branagh, Vanessa Redgrave, amongst many others. Her name is Christine Court, and it's a privilege to have you in here, Christine. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Clint. I'm all right. Bit of a cold, but I'm going to motor through.
You're sounding all right so far.
Thanks.
And it'll get easier as the show goes on. So first of all, we are going to talk about your career. We're going to talk about the amazing work you've done with the Manchester International Festival over the years. We're going to talk about the city of Manchester and its spirit. That's what we're all about here. Let's start by talking about your upbringing. You were born and raised in Blackburn, I believe.
I was. Working class girl through and through. Mum worked in Boots on the pharmacy counter. My dad was a gas fitter, and I was always getting told off going to see my mum in Boots because my hair was back combed. I had my granddad's coat on that was full of holes, and I wasn't respectable enough for going to see my mum when she was working.
So, you were a child of the 60s, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I was. Always been a bit of a rebel.
Yeah. Amazing times.
Yeah.
And music was a bit of a thing for you as well, wasn't it? As it was with myself and
definitely,
all.
Definitely, always. You know, when I was growing up in Blackburn, I was that girl who used to organise folk to get out of Blackburn. So I used to organise a minibus on a Saturday night, meeting at 8, from Blackburn Boulevard and going to Legends or Pips, 16 of us, and it was always packed. I sort of knew from that point, you know, when I was like, well, nobody else is going to organise it. I knew that I was going to start organising for a career.
Isn't that funny, that? Started off little minibus in Blackburn.
Yeah, yeah.
And look at you now.
Definitely.
Bringing people like York Horner into town and David Lynch.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't wait to get talking about the International Festival because it's quite a unique thing that you've started there. But let's go back to your first... how did you do at school? Were you a clever kid or were you a bit of a, rebel?
I was a clever kid, but I was totally diverted by music and nightclubs and boys,
right,
if I'm totally honest. I got to about 16 and I was like, whoa, there's a whole world out there. So I used to go to the Lodestar with my old pal who I saw at the weekend who did National Festival of Making, Wayne Hemingway, ex-Red or Dead. So we'd go, my dad was the hero of all the dads, bar none. He would take us, me and my three friends, on a Friday night. He'd take us at 8 o'clock. I wasn't really allowed to go, I was 15. Mm-hmm. And then he'd come and pick us up. He'd set his alarm and come pick us up at 3 a.m. So I've always had that dancing, spirit, clubs, live music. I love popular culture. Yeah. It's been in me forever. Before I even knew what culture meant, I just knew I love live events.
I just want to go off on a little tangent here because you mentioned the Lodestar.
Yeah.
I went there once.
Did you?
And I was big into the punk music from 1976 onwards. It was just all about the punk. And then one night in probably 1977, it would be Top of the Pops night, so probably Thursday night.
Yeah.
And the band that were on the TV was The Adverts.
Yeah.
And this is probably not quite your generation. I'm thinking you might have been a bit later than this in terms of going to Lodestar. But we found out from the NME they were playing in Preston that night at the Lodestar, or Preston, between Preston and Blackburn.
Ribchester it is. Yeah. It's between Preston and Blackburn.
So bear in mind, I lived in Oldham with my mum and dad. I had a moped. I had a best friend in Rochdale. I drove my moped to his house in Rochdale. Like, let's go watch this band. They're playing over the hills tonight. We got the last bus towards Preston. Managed to find our way to the Lodestar, which is just in the middle of a moor.
Yes, so private house.
We were two like working class kids from this end of the world. Just found our way, and we saw the band who met the adverts.
Wow.
And
it's like a cavern, wasn't it? It was like a
cave. Like that, And it's the building's still there now. It's a private house now.
It's got a great big wall around it. I'm always trying to peer over it. I live quite near there now.
And they're like, go and play up your own end.
Yeah, yeah. But it was run by a wonderful woman called Margaret Grimshaw. Yeah. My mum always used to say, I'm not sure this is true, she was the first topless barmaid in Blackburn. And then she opened this club. Oh, my God, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And I was way, way too young to go. I just went every week.
Yeah, it was amazing. People like that, though, that you mentioned there, they're just these pioneers that made some amazing things happen around the country. I mean, the Electric Circus in Collyhurst, where I saw the Sex Pistols on the Anarchy Tour, they were like one of only probably two towns in the country that didn't cancel the Pistols gigs after the controversy on TV.
Exactly.
So thankfully, we had all these amazing people keeping things moving for us. Yeah. And what about your first jobs, then?
First jobs, my very first job was, I've always liked human beings. I think that's my best thing. Grumpy ones, wonderful ones, funny ones. I've worked in cafes. I used to work in Boots when my mum got me the job on the record counter. Do you remember when Boots had records?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where I met my husband. He came in with a friend. I went to London. I studied in Liverpool and I went to London because I sort of knew that in Blackburn and in the north for me then, I just knew I wanted to do something different. A lot of my friends were going to be accountants or solicitors or doctors. You know, I went to a comprehensive school, but they were all quite aspirational. Mm. But I just knew I wanted to work in the arts. I didn't even know what that was. So I went to London and I did a diploma in management and administration of the arts after my degree. And I taught my way. There were only two places. I've always had a very clear head on what I wanted to do. I only wanted to work in two places in London, Riverside Studios or the ICA, the Institute of Contemporary Arts, because they were right at the top of their game. And both offered me a job. And I ended up working at Riverside as like chief envelope stuffer, you know. But you know, when you're that age, you're like a sponge, you're just soaking everything up. And I just stuffed thousands of envelopes, but I'd be listening. Brian Eno's our choreographer in residence. Michael Clark's coming in to do this dance piece. Vanessa Redgrave's doing a recital. And I'd be like, can I go? Can I just come? I'll bring all the envelopes. I'll stuff them, but can I just listen? And I learned so much. And then they I just kept getting promoted and promoted and promoted. And then by the end, I was marketing director. And we had a gallery, we had a bookshop, we had two studio spaces where we did the most extraordinary international work. We had Live from Riverside, which was a TV program where lots of bands used to come. We had a brilliant restaurant and a good bar. So it was like from a very early age, I was immersed across art forms. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was learning so much. That's where I learned the most.
Yeah, that's amazing. And wait, was that pre-TFI Friday at the Riverside?
Yeah, that was way before TFI
Friday. Were you aware of that amazing history that it had as a TV studio?
Definitely. One of my first projects was to spend about a month at the BBC researching, you know, the first place that colour TV was made
was
at
Riverside. Wow.
And, you know, I used to look after lots of the artists. Do you remember Max Wall?
Yeah, the comedian.
He was doing a wonderful piece, Crap's Last Tape, Beckett. Right. And he took a real shine to me. And I was to take him to Wogan, you know, to be interviewed on Wogan to promote Crap's Last Tape. And I was really told not to let him stop by a pub. Whatever I do, do not stop the car because he mustn't have a drink before he goes on Wogan. Anyway, he persuaded me to stop the car at a brilliant pub in Shepherd's Bush. He had two pints, went on to Wogan, didn't promote the show. I thought I was going to get sacked. But then he came off Wogan and then did a double take and Wogan promoted it. So I had wonderful times with amazing artists.
Yeah.
Really
and,
lucky.
And you were still only just fresh out of your teens.
Yeah, I was early 20s, really early 20s.
And then you got headhunted. Was it the Conran, Terence Conran?
Yeah, people? I did. I knew Sebastian Conran because he lived near Riverside. And I went to work at the Design Museum, which was on Shad Thames. I can liken it to some areas around Manchester. It was, you know, that have now been super developed, like Ancoats and stuff. It was at a time where it was just like a barren wasteland and the Design Museum were there. So it's a huge job to do in terms of bringing audiences out of central London to this bastion for design.
Yeah.
If I'm super honest, Clint, it wasn't really me. It was like, you know, my mum and dad came from Blackburn. I had a beautiful office overlooking the Thames.
Yeah.
Gorgeous crockery their tea was served in. But for me, in those days, it was quite surface. It was, and I'd loved the realness of Riverside.
Yeah.
And I just, it didn't suit my temperament.
Was it not creative enough? Because it was all to do with showing off other people's work, etc.
It was. But I just found it just wasn't right for me. And I was super lucky because when I'd been at Riverside, I'd done loads of work with Time Out, the listings magazine. And I'd met lots of journalists there, the film critics, the marketing people, the comedy people, because Riverside spanned art forms. And when a job was going, someone from there said, "Hey, you know, we really want you to come in and talk about this job."
Right.
And Time Out is, you know, I lived London. You know when some people say they live in London but they barely do anything?
Yeah.
When I was at Riverside, whenever I do anything, I try and completely throw myself at it.
Yeah.
And I did go to gigs. I did go to openings. I did go to restaurants. I did go to bars. I went to loads and loads of film premieres. So when this job came up at Time Out that I was being lined up for, as like, I've got to do it. I've got to do it. So that was, I went in as marketing manager into a wonderful team of human beings. And Tony, who owns Time Out, founder and owner then, is still one of my closest friends in all the world. He cares passionately about information and its dissemination and connecting people to art and culture. And that's something I really care about. So, yeah, I got a great job at Time Out.
Sounds like the other Tony from up this part of the world, Tony Wilson.
Very much like Tony Wilson.
A real catalyst, getting
and
people together.
And when I brought Tony Elliott for the first time to Manchester, when we were starting the festival, I got a room of 10 people. Sorry, I didn't invite you.
That's all right.
Around who...
I was probably DJing or something.
Yeah, exactly. Who I thought Tony Elliott would really like to meet. And Tony Wilson was definitely one
Amazing.
Of those people.
Amazing. And you were at Time Out then for 12 years or so?
I was there for a long time, but I had 3 different jobs. So I ran divisions like the guides division. So I don't know if you remember that Time Out used to have probably 100 plus guides. So Time Out guide to Paris, London, Amsterdam, et cetera, et cetera. And that was an amazing collaboration with Penguin Books.
Right.
I learned a lot at Time Out about the harsh realities of a commercial environment. So I remember I'd had Riverside, which was really creative. I'd had a stint at the Design Museum, which was a foot in both worlds. And then at Time Out, it really gave me a solid grounding in commercial acumen, I hope.
Yeah.
You know, I worked at Time Out when we were selling 110,000 copies a week to Londoners.
Wow.
And when you're selling 110,000 copies, 5 or 6 people were reading a copy. So you're getting to, this is predating online, you're getting to almost 1 million folk spreading the message about what to do across cities across the world. So
I remember at its peak, it was the definitive guide to what was going on, isn't it?
For sure, for sure. And Tony Elliott cares very much about, it doesn't have to be top end, but about quality. And he has instilled that in me. You know, I will walk past 10 perfectly acceptable restaurants that are half empty to queue at a perfect one.
Really?
I really believe you just live once. You've got to have it as good as it can be. And part of my job, both with Time Out and the festival, is hopefully bringing things to people that are going to really help make them think.
Yeah.
And possibly, when it's super successful, help change lives.
Right. And which is what the next chapter is, because you did 12 years at Time Out.
I did.
You left essentially to spend more time with your family, didn't you?
I did. I felt I'm an only child, incredibly close to both of my parents, both sadly deceased now. And I felt when I was at Time Out, I felt that I was always somewhere else. I had, I got promoted when my son, when I was on maternity leave, I got promoted to essentially group marketing director, which meant I was working a lot more internationally in New York, in Lisbon, in Paris, in Abu Dhabi, in Dubai. And I just thought to myself, I'm not going to know my son, my husband, who I love, I'm still with him, been with him since I was 18. They're going to have a bond, which is amazing, but I'm not going to be part of that unit. So I bravely jacked in, I think, one of the best jobs in the world.
Yeah.
Wonderful salary, gorgeous connections, global community. And I promised myself I would have a year off. We were going to move back to the north. For a very long time, we've had a very simple house at the foot of Pendle Hill, 2 up, 2 down. So we left this frenetic Brixton Hill life to all our stuff went into store. And we came to our house in Bali. And I, you know, we'd been for weekends over a few years. And I could just see the sort of residents thinking, oh, who are this posh London lot coming up here? So I said to Paul, we're going to have a party. And he's like, how can we have a party? We don't know anybody. And I said,
get a minibus.
That's it. Well, I had to stay put. So Paul, being an artist, did an invitation. Mm. And Jack and me pushed them through about, it's a small place, Bali. It's got a population of about 200. Pushed them through about 60 doors, no idea who'd come. The whole village rocked up. And of course, we didn't know the tea room had fallen out with the pub, who'd fallen out with the farmer. We just invited everybody. And lots of differences were reconciled. Tea room didn't open the day after because people had had a really good time. pub opened late, et cetera, et cetera. So it goes back to that thing for me about connecting people.
Yeah.
So we arrived in Bali. showed the community that we were wanted to be part of it. And I was literally going to walk Jack, my son, to school through fields. And about 2 weeks into that idyllic time, mm-hmm. I got a call from a chap called Alex Poots, who had been newly appointed festival director, chief exec of a new thing called Manchester International Festival. Now, I'd worked with Alex for years in London. We were friends. He'd come to my leaving party. He would come to Time Out and say, hey, would Time Out support Fatboy Slim on Brighton Beach? Would Time Out support Channel 4 have approached me to try and make cricket more democratic and appeal to a younger audience? So I'm doing a big thing on Clapham Common with music and cricket. Would Time Out support that? So we'd become friends through work.
Yeah.
And he said, I heard you were back. I really want you to help me set up this festival. And I was like, absolutely no chance. I'm having a year off. And I don't know if you've ever met Alexander, but he's one of the most persuasive human beings you're ever likely to encounter.
Yeah.
He kept ringing. And then in the end, he said, just meet me in Urbis for a cup of tea. How can you not do that as a working class girl from Blackburn who's back, who cares a lot about culture? So I met him and he was saying, you know, the city went for my crazy notion of a festival of firsts over 18 days every 2 years, putting artists right at the centre, enabling them to realise their dreams, the thing that had been wearing around in their minds that they'd never have the opportunity to do. We will make that in Manchester. Audiences will come from the region nationally and internationally, and then we'll take that work out on the road. How can you not be part of that? So to cut a long, quite painful story short, I acquiesced.
The irony is all these years later, he's buggered off to America and lucky to do it, hasn't he?
Get me! Still here!
Was it totally his vision then? What you described just then, was that his vision?
Do you know, I think it really was. Yeah. I think the city leaders, and by that I probably mean Sir Richard and Sir Howard, leader and chief executive then, respectfully, of Manchester City Council. I think post-Commonwealth Games knew that it was smart to build on the momentum of the Games.
So the Games of 2002. You and I were talking, 2006?
About 2004, I think they devised this notion of a festival.
Yeah.
And then I think they headhunted far and wide and invited people who were right at the top of their game to come up to Manchester, or folk who are in Manchester as well, I'm sure, to say, if you were to get the job of director of this festival, what would your idea be? Mm. Now, I think that was really smart of the city, not determining what the festival should be, but just knowing the economic impact, the profile, the goodwill, the volunteers, and everything that had ensued around the Commonwealth Games, not allowing that to dissipate, allowing that to build. And Alex's vision was the one I outlined. Yeah. So I think it was probably, I don't know what all the other visions were.
Because the Commonwealth Games totally transformed the world's perception of this city. There was other great things
going on.
We mentioned Anthony Wilson before. Anthony Wilson had done monumental things to draw attention to what we're doing here.
Yeah.
But the Commonwealth Games was like, you could just feel everybody in the world looking at our city.
Yeah.
And we were there on the Friday night when people found out. What was that? You remember when 828 State did a gig? What was that when they did a gig at Castlefield? There was some announcement to do with Olympics. Was it when we didn't quite get the Olympic announcement?
I'm not sure.
I think there was something there. But just at that moment, I just thought, the world's watching us. We're all about partying.
Yeah,
we just had this bad news. You're not going to do the Olympics. But
we're
having a rave instead.
Yeah. And that's a really good point about Anthony Wilson, because Alex was very good friends, and still is, as am I, with Peter Saville. And I think it was Peter who helped Alex form his pitch, if you like, for the city. You know, I think Peter's perspective of Manchester being the original modern city, the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, suffragette movement, birthplace of the computer, etc., etc. And I think Peter was talking to Alex about, for a successful city festival, it needs to be born out of the fabric, the DNA of the the place, and that Manchester being a city of firsts, a festival of first, would be a very good thing to suggest to a city like Manchester. Well, there is no city like Manchester in the world, thank God. So I think that's how that came about. And, you know, it is really risky doing a festival of new work. And there are really good reasons for not doing that. You know, so if you take something on a run from London and then show it in Manchester after it's done 10 weeks in London, London has had all the problems with that run. They've worked them all through. Also, a lot of the expense is in setup, so it's risky artistically. Yeah. It's eye-wateringly expensive often. So it was very, very brave. I can not commend Manchester City Council enough for sticking with the festival since its inception, when I'm sure the amount of pressure on their budgets, and rightly so, from health, education, all quarters, homelessness, must have been immense.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the highlights over the years for you of the festival?
Oh, Clint Boone, that's a really unfair question. Okay, so I've got so many. I think probably the very first commission we ever did in the very first festival, Monkey Journey to the West.
Yeah, I saw that.
Did you?
Amazing.
Yay.
Yeah.
And because I think what it did, it demonstrated the ambition in one commission. So, you know, let's talk about it. An opera in Mandarin.
Yeah.
It's not a quick sell.
By Damon Albarn.
By Damon Albarn and Shen Shizheng.
Yeah.
But it was, even if you didn't get the narrative, it was sumptuously beautiful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The Chinese acrobats and the lighting and the scale of it. I think that, and the fact that 27% of audiences who came to that commission had never stepped foot in a cultural venue before.
Yeah.
And it's that, I love that about the work we do and its potential about bringing new audiences to see stuff they didn't even know they might like.
Yeah.
And then that gives them a sort of inner confidence, if you like, to try something next time and to continually push themselves.
Yeah,
I think that was one of my favourites. I think another one was Johnny Vegas in a house in Chorlton. You know, when you're booking tickets to a show, you don't know if you're one of 20 or if you're one of 1,000, do you, unless they're numbered. Mm. So about 25 people every performance met outside Manchester Central, where they, I think, presumed they were going to see Johnny Vegas perform a comedy show. And they were ushered onto a minibus. We'd employed an estate agent who had done particulars for this house in Chorlton. Then there was about a 20-30 minute minibus ride with this 25 audience. They were tipped off the minibus. They had the particulars of the house. And then they knocked on the house, the bravest one, and Johnny opened the door and then spent the next hour trying to sell the 25 folk his house.
Oh, amazing.
And it sounds fun, you know, so everyone went into the kitchen and he's like, what do you want a brew? Do you want a beer? What's your favourite drink? What do you like eating? It was very conversational. And then the further up the house they got, looking at the various rooms, the scarier and darker it became. And Johnny's quite a big personality. And when you've only got that few an audience, he can really take over. And he'd seen too many, the premise was he'd seen too many TV makeover programmes. And he'd incarcerated his wife on the top floor. And she was screaming and banging to get out. And by the end, people were running for the minibus. That was really funny and macabre at the same time.
Yeah. Who picks? Because the big thing about the festival is that I can't phone you up and say, come on, I want to come and do a DJ gig or a performance. You guys make the approach, don't you? And,
yeah.
And how does that process work?
There's a bit of both now. We've got, so John McGrath is the CEO and artistic director. And we've got a whole team of executive producers and producers, a brilliant team. Best in the world, for sure.
It's a massive team, isn't it? I was surprised.
It's big now. Yeah, we've got about 125. And then also what you've got to think about is we've got about 300 suppliers, so we pour a lot of resource into the region as well. About 500 volunteers,
yeah.
Maybe with all the tech crews and everything, it could be up to about 1,000 people.
And for people listening, this isn't us in Manchester just having a big party on taxpayers' money. It brings in a lot of money.
Tell us some figures
what it brings in.
So in terms of economic impact, over £40 million over 18 days. People come from 50 different countries. So people who run the best institutions all over the world to look at what Manchester's doing.
Yeah.
So people from Helsinki, Singapore, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Melbourne. God, I think the arts world in Melbourne is emptying. Sydney Opera House, New York, they're all coming. And what we've got to remember is when they're coming here to see the festival, they're staying over in hotels, they're shopping in shops, they're going to other cultural organisations.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't just about us. It's about the whole of the city to celebrate what we're great at.
It's not just you and your mates in a minibus going to Pips anymore, is it?
Definitely not. Definitely
and this year, you've got the big names this year. David Lynch is involved.
Yeah.
Yoko Ono.
Yes.
Laurie Anderson. That's just three amazing names that are going to be putting some incredible stuff on here.
So the opening event is a wonderful thing where I invite the people of Manchester to join us. Yoko will be directing, whether she's there in person or directing via a film, a huge choir, a huge number of people, we hope about 8,000 people, who will ring bells for peace.
Wow.
And never have we needed that so much.
And David Lynch, is he curating a load of films at the home?
He is. He's doing a home takeover.
Right.
So visual arts, music, and film. Yeah. And I think it's the largest exhibition of his work.
Right.
His visual art.
And the Maxine Peake Nico thing sounds incredible.
Can't wait for that. So I didn't know, did you? That you probably did, actually.
Yeah, she lived here.
Last 10 years of her life.
Yeah, well, when she died, she was still based in Manchester. She died in Spain, I think, but she was very much based here for the end of her life.
I've talked to, I know Eric Random worked with her quite a bit and, well, a lot. And so I think what Maxine isn't doing is an exact rendition of Nico.
Yeah.
She's doing her take with wonderful Sarah Frankham from the Royal Exchange. You know, I've worked with Maxine several times now. She's a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be a really good one.
Be powerful. And a lot of these shows, they're created for the Manchester International Festival, but quite often they do go off and tour the world with them, don't they?
Precisely. I think more than 1 million people now have seen our work internationally live outside of Manchester.
But when this one's done, if somebody came to you in 6 months' time and said, right, we've got this amazing opportunity, move to Vancouver, you and your family, we want to do the same as the Manchester International Festival in Vancouver or San Fran or Tokyo, what would you do? Would you say, stuff it?
I care so much about the Northwest that I wouldn't say stuff it because that would be rude. I'd say no, thank you. I think that, and I have had extraordinary offers to go to other places that are, you know, drop dead exciting offers. But I am a Blackburn girl. This makes me a bit tearful through and through. And the prospect of the factory and what that will enable for generations of young people in terms of skills and learning and training opportunities is too important for me to turn my back on.
This is something that, with all respect, the man in the street isn't aware of what's about to happen. It's
absolutely
being built about 100 yards from where we are sitting at the moment, the old Granada Studios.
Yeah.
There's a complex being built on there. It's called The Factory. It's going to be inspired by a lot of Anthony Wilson's mindset and Andy Warhol's factory. It's just going to be this massive arts complex that will be making TV and it will be for dance development. And it's being built here and I don't think people realise what it is. But like you said, the tens of thousands of people that are going to benefit from that, millions of people over the next couple of decades.
And Manchester has a brilliant cultural infrastructure, but it needs a building on this scale.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to have a truly flexible arts facility that will have a combined capacity of about 7,000. We need it.
Yeah, definitely.
And we deserve it.
Yeah.
You know, and that there will always be a piece of work being made in there. Actually, in the true sense of the word factory, a place where things are made.
Yeah.
And that being madeness burst open, and the apprenticeships and skills and learning built into the core of that. So those sort of back of stage jobs, you know, box office, technical, all of that stuff, that people will be skilled in those sectors,
yeah,
here in this city. They won't have to go to London. They won't have to go to Paris. But then they'll be skilled, and then they can go.
Yeah.
You know, I think, and then there'll always be something being made and then something being presented. And, you know, that presentation aspect will have people, it's very important that Manchester embraces this. This is for them.
Absolutely.
It's for the people of Manchester. It's for the nation. It will have international resonance as, yeah, well.
Try and describe the spirit of Manchester, Christine.
Eclectic, infuriating, hilarious, warm, tenacious, and vital.
Who are your favourite humans of Manchester ever? Because you're our current guest on Humans of Excess Manchester. Yeah. Who are your favourite humans of Manchester? The people that most inspired you? And they don't actually have to be Mancunians as such.
No. I have loved working with Sir Howard Bernstein over a 12-year period. I have found him inspirational in terms of his support for the festival and his vision for the city. I have really learnt a lot from him. I also have enjoyed seeing Maxine, who we talked about earlier, and I suppose someone like Peter Saville. I would say Tony. I loved Tony. He was always very, very kind to me.
Mm-hmm.
He really loved it when I came back. He used to love it when people came back from London.
We're talking about Tony Wilson, aren't we?
Yeah, sorry, Tony, yeah, Wilson. But I think Peter, who's still one of my creative advisors on the festival and, you know, in developing the brand for the factory, he's being really crucial, mm-hmm, in that. So I think those people have,
that's
been,
good,
but there have been many, many more.
Yeah, brilliant. Before you go then, Christine, describe Manchester in three words.
So Manchester to me in three words, I'd rather do 30. So here are my three. Infuriating, innovative, and bold.
Brilliant, Christine. Don't ever stop hiring those minibuses. Thank you, Christine Court, for being a human of Excess Manchester.
Thank you, Clint.
That was Christine Court. Next week, I'm joined by musician and co-owner of Jimmy's Bar in the Northern Quarter, George Craig. Don't forget to follow us on social media and subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester. Rate us, feel free to leave us some feedback. We love hearing what you think about our work. Thanks again to our friends at Safer Roads GM for sponsoring this series, and thank you for listening. See you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.